We have the telephone conference hookup for people to listen in, so we'll be waiting for a minute for that to go online. When you hear a bit of music, that's what that's about. When the music starts, and we'll start. So please bear with us for a moment. Is the intercall operator? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, are we ready to go here?
You're in the live conference now.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
All right, let's go on the record. Good morning to all of you. My name is George Hastings, and I'm a special master of the United States Court of Federal Claims. To my left is Denise Vowell, a special master of the Court of Federal Claims, and to my right is Patricia Campbell-Smith, a third special master. Together, we'd like to welcome you all to a special evidentiary hearing of the United States Court of Federal Claims. Today, we are here for two purposes. One purpose is to hear the claim under the Vaccine Act of Michelle Cedillo. Michelle is a 12-year-old who lives in Arizona and who has been diagnosed with autism and a number of other medical conditions. The first purpose of this hearing is to determine whether Michelle's own autism and her other conditions were vaccine caused. However, there is another equally important purpose for this hearing. That is, Michelle is one of nearly 5,000 children diagnosed with autism or similar disorders who have filed compensation claims under the Vaccine Act. These 5,000 claims have been grouped together in a joint proceeding known as the Omnibus Autism Proceeding. The committee of attorneys who represent the petitioners in the Omnibus Autism Proceeding has designated Michelle's case as the first test case in that proceeding. Therefore, in this hearing, Today and over the next 3 weeks, we will hear not only about Michelle's own condition, but also extensive expert testimony concerning the petitioner's first general causation theory. That is, the general theory that MMR vaccines and thimerosal-containing vaccines can combine to cause autism. These two purposes explain why up here on the bench you see three special masters, not just one. Under the Vaccine Act, individual claims are to be decided by a single special master. And I am the special master who has been assigned the particular case of Michelle Cedillo, so that I alone will decide Michelle's own particular case. The other two special masters sitting up here with me, on the other hand, are here in order to hear the general causation testimony to be presented during this hearing. Those two special masters will then apply that general causation testimony to other individual Vaccine Act cases that are assigned to them. I want to begin this hearing then by acknowledging the most important people who are in the courtroom today, the Cedillo family. With us here today, though they'll be in and out of the courtroom on account of Michelle, are Michelle Cedillo herself, her mother, Teresa Cedillo, and Michelle's father, Michael Cedillo. I understand, and I've met this morning, several other family members who are with us today. We thank the Cedillos for being here with us. Also, on behalf of myself and my colleagues, I wish to extend our sympathy to Michelle and her family for all they've been through. Clearly, the story of Michelle's life is a tragic one. She and her family have been through some very difficult times, and they are deserving of sympathy, but also deserving, in my mind, of admiration for the way they've coped with Michelle's illness. We thank the Cedillo family for very generously agreeing to have Michelle's case designated as the first test case in the omnibus autism proceeding. Teresa Cedillo will herself be testifying in this hearing, probably later today. Again, we thank all of the Cedillos for their participation in this hearing. We also wish to thank the counsel for both sides who will be presenting their evidence during this hearing. We know that they have worked enormously hard to prepare for this hearing, and we appreciate that hard work. We also thank the expert witnesses who have agreed to testify before us. We thank the judges of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit who have generously allowed us to take over their largest courtroom for the next 3 weeks. We thank the United States Marshals and all of the other wonderful employees of both of the courts housed in this building, especially Brian Bishop and Don Palmer, who have assisted us very ably in preparing for and conducting this hearing. Next, I want to mention some other people who are also very important to this proceeding. That is the families of all the other 5,000 Vaccine Act claimants who have been diagnosed with autism or similar conditions. Some of those families, I think, are in the courtroom with us here today, and we extend to such families a very special welcome. Some other of those families are listening in now by our special teleconferencing system, or they intend to listen to the audio portion of this hearing by downloading it from the internet. To all such family members, as to the Cedillo family, we three special masters pledge to you that we will listen very carefully to the evidence put before us at this hearing and give that evidence our very complete and careful study. We realize what a very important task has been assigned to us in deciding these cases, and we will give our greatest effort in carrying out that heavy responsibility. Finally, for those of you who will be here or listening to this hearing for more than just today, I'd like to give you a brief roadmap of the proceedings. We will begin at 9 a.m. Eastern Time each day. We will take a lunch break of about 1 hour, probably sometime about 1 p.m. We will adjourn each day, probably sometime around 6 p.m., but sometimes earlier or later, depending on the witness schedule. And please, all of you with cell phones, please do turn them off. With that, we are ready to begin the proceedings, I believe. And we're going to start with opening statements by counsel for the petitioners. So which of you will be starting, Mr. Powers?
Special Master, I'll be starting, and Mr. Jim Kaplan will be giving an opening specific to the test case today.
Okay. Mr. Powers will make an opening statement on behalf of the Petitioner Steering Committee. Mr. Powers, please go ahead.
Thank you, Special Masters, and good morning, Council, folks in the room and folks listening over the web, and folks who will be listening later. My name is Tom Powers. I'm one of the attorneys on the Petitioner Steering Committee. That's a group of lawyers who represent the 4,800-plus claimants in the omnibus autism proceeding. It's a privilege to represent these families, and it's a privilege to work on behalf of the attorneys that are representing those families individually. I'm here today to describe from the petitioner's point of view three main things. The first is, from the petitioner's perspective, why we're here and how we got here. The second is to describe what's happened over the past 5 years in the omnibus proceeding. And the third is to talk about the expectations from today and moving forward. First off, the reason that we're here today, as Special Master Hastings has already described, is that we're going to hear one test case. It's the first of a series of test cases. This is a test case by the Cedillo family that's going to address general issues of causation on the theory of causation that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause immune system problems and suppression that makes certain children vulnerable or susceptible to viral infections that can cause neurological injuries, including many of the symptoms of autism, and that the MMR in particular is a viral agent that has caused autism in a number of these children, including in Michelle Cedillo. If you notice from that description, it's not a test case today about the medical or scientific theory that thimerosal in and of itself has neurotoxic or other properties that in and of itself can cause these injuries. There will be later test cases addressing that theory. So this test case is addressing one particular theory of causation. Why are we here? Well, we're here for several reasons. One of the main reasons we're here is that Congress said claims like this need to come here. They need to come into the vaccine program. They need to come into the vaccine program because Congress faced a crisis in the 1980s. Vaccines were causing a significant number of very serious injuries in the pediatric population. A lot of injured kids were having extremely bad reactions to certain vaccines. To get compensation, those families had to go through the civil litigation process. That's a highly adversarial, extremely time-consuming, remarkably expensive process. Congress decided as a matter of policy, and we're not here to debate the policy, but Congress decided and has resolved that as a matter of policy, there were three goals in setting up the vaccine program. The first was to protect manufacturers from civil liability. The second was to encourage vaccines to be used and administered and developed. And the third was to provide a fair, just, speedy, and generous compensation program for those children, hopefully a small number, ideally rare, but expected adverse reactions to vaccines. That's the program's goal. And so children who are injured by a vaccine need to come to this program, and that's where they are today, the Cedillo family and the other families in the omnibus. Now, the omnibus proceeding itself is created because of the sheer number of claims. As the special masters described, nearly 5,000 claimants who allege that thimerosal, the MMR, or a combination of them, cause these serious injuries. These are families, and it's important to understand this. These are families who followed the rules. These are the families that brought their children in for pediatric vaccines. These are the families that immunized their children. The public policy decision on mass immunization is a trade-off. It is expected that there will be, and again, hopefully rare and infrequent, but expected that there will be severe adverse reactions when millions and millions of children every year are being given millions and millions of pediatric vaccines. The idea, and it's a social compact is that families individually assume an extremely tiny risk of harm for the greater good. And it's an important social compact. It's a social compact that's based on trust. It's based on the families, and these families have trust. It's based on the trust that the vaccines being used are as safe as they can be, and it's based on trust that if an individual family suffers a serious injury, there will be a fair compensation system that they can go to. And these are the families that trusted the system, and these are the families that followed the rules, and these are the families that suffer injuries for the greater good. There's no doubt that mass immunization programs are a great public benefit. They have prevented huge numbers of infectious diseases and prevented tens of thousands of deaths and serious injuries that historically individuals and society have had to bear the burden of. But these are the families participating in that program again, trusting in the program, who are now here seeking compensation because they unfortunately were the ones that got hurt. It's important to remember that this is a no-fault system. So in this test case and in the other test cases that you'll hear, it's not about did anybody do something wrong. It's not about negligence. It's not about liability. It's about proving by a preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, that thimerosal, the MMR, a combination of the two, caused or was a substantial contributing cause for the serious injuries that these children have suffered. It's important also to remember the legal standard and what Congress wanted and what case law says will apply here, that in close calls on causation ought to go to the petitioner. And again, that's to provide a just, fair compensation system for the inevitable injuries that are going to result from mass immunization programs. It's not scientific certainty, because frankly, the science is in dispute. That's what you're going to hear in these 3 weeks, and that's what you're going to hear in all the test cases. The science is in dispute, and this issue is not scientific certainty. It's more likely than not on a balance of the evidence. What this is not about is anti-vaccines. And I can tell you that as somebody representing these injured families and talking to a lot of these families, it is shameful, frankly, some of the institutional disinformation and distortion that you hear, and whether it comes from industry, from the pharmaceutical industry, from the HMOs, from the medical establishment, or from the government itself, from government agency spokespeople, saying that these families are out to sink the vaccine program, that these families are anti-vaccine, that these families think we should not have shots that protect people from infectious diseases, and that is disinformation, that's distortion, that isn't true, and it's shameful. I want to talk about what's happened in the 5 years since this proceeding began. General Order No. 1 in July 2002 set up the Omnibus Autism Proceeding. The dynamic has been, from day one, and even from before the Omnibus was set up, that you have the respondent, the Department of Justice really acting as the attorneys for the respondent, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. But when it comes down to it, it's the federal government. The federal government is the respondent in these cases. And from day one, the respondent and industry have been on the same side of the table, standing shoulder to shoulder, doing everything they can to make sure that this climb towards proving causation is as long and as steep and as hard as it can possibly be. Numerous obstacles that I'll describe in detail have been placed in the path of the petitioners, seeking that fair, speedy, generous, expeditious compensation that Congress said they're entitled to. Way back in 2002, before this process was set up, the vaccine court was here, but the omnibus wasn't. Some families had filed lawsuits in the civil justice system, asking courts, and particularly asking juries, to decide the issue of whether they had been injured by vaccines, suing the pharmaceutical industry and the vaccine manufacturers directly. Well, as one would expect, and I filed one of these cases in Portland, Oregon, as one would expect, and I totally expected it, pharmaceutical industry lawyers were on the other table telling the federal judge to dismiss the case and send these children out of the courthouse. They shouldn't have a claim in front of a jury, and they should instead come to the vaccine program. What I didn't expect then was that the U.S. government was standing literally, physically, shoulder to shoulder with industry, telling a U.S. district court judge that these children ought to be tossed out of federal court and that they ought to come here, taking the same side as industry from day one. And that's continued through the course of the program. It took a long time to get the omnibus proceedings set up, and credit, I think, goes to the special masters. The special masters here and the chief special master, who really were fairly creative and designed a proceeding that can accommodate a huge caseload of related claims and set up the omnibus proceeding. DOJ fought at several key steps in the way to implement that proceeding. For example, the special masters decided that with 4,800 claims coming into the program, with a statute of limitations and radically unfair, draconian short statute of limitations that cuts off a lot of claims before the families even know they have a claim, with the clock running on those claims, that there would be a rush to get cases filed in this program. And so they provided a very simple mechanism to let families do that in a quick, easy, inexpensive way, rather than having to quickly file full sets of medical records and expert reports and affidavits to fill out a short form petition to stop the clock of their claim and get a place in line in the program. DOJ fought that. DOJ resisted that, and even though they have lost on that issue, for those families who are here and those families listening to this broadcast, you all have received that letter from your federal government saying, you haven't done what you need to do, in our opinion, and your claim is subject to dismissal. Fighting every step of the way. Again, families who played by the rules. These families filed their claims like they were told to do. They relied on what the special master said would be the process, but they still get a letter saying, well, you haven't done what you need, and we're reserving our right to toss your case out. And that's just not right. Something else that we've seen happen in the last 5 years in this program is a simple inability to get important, critical information and evidence that these petitioners need to prove individual cases and to prove general causation. In the civil justice system, there's a process called discovery. It's available as a matter of right. If a party to litigation believes that somebody on the other side of the litigation has relevant information, material information, they're entitled to simply ask for it, and they get it. And if they don't get it, the judge tells the other side, you got to cough it up. There's no right of discovery in the program. The parties, and I'm speaking for the petitioners don't have the right to simply ask for and receive from the other side, from the federal government, important information about the science and the medicine in these cases. And that's an unusual situation when you look at the facts in this litigation and the facts related to the vaccine program. A lot of the evidence and a lot of the information on the science and the medicine is controlled by the federal government. In fact, even generated by the federal government. The federal government funds studies. The federal government actually conducts studies among its various client agencies and client entities, looking at this issue, developing information, developing facts, developing things that would potentially be evidence, but we can't get them. They have it. They're generating it. And we largely cannot get it. For virtually every bit of information that we've received, the petitioners have received from the respondent, we've had to litigate. Special Master Hastings has been on this case for 5 years, from day one. And we, for years, have been having to put in front of him motions to compel, motions demanding that the special masters force the Department of Justice to turn over important, relevant information. Information about studies that the government is doing. Information about studies that the government has planned. things that one would normally get, again, in civil litigation, as a matter of right. If they're going to rely on a study, we want it, and we ask, to have the files of the investigators, to look at the data, the actual data that the investigators used, to even take the depositions of the investigators, to really sort of look and see if those studies are legitimate, if those studies hold water, and if they're relevant, to get that information. And it's not just for our benefit, it's for the benefit of the special masters, because absent a jury, the special masters will be deciding these cases. And our position has always been that to make the best decision, you need the best information. Transparent, open, accessible, available to both sides, not just to one side. We've had to fight those motions for the last 5 years. One big area where we've sought information is related to the vaccine safety data link. The vaccine safety data link is a huge database involving millions of children, and it gives you a unique opportunity to match the vaccine exposures of groups of children against their medical outcomes, an extremely powerful database. Probably, and this is, as various government entities have described it, perhaps the richest source of information, the richest source of data that would allow people to do population studies to determine whether there are associations or causal associations between various vaccine exposures and various health outcomes. We've been fighting for 3.5 years to get access to the vaccine safety data link and have been frustrated in all of those efforts. In 2002, this vaccine safety data link that the federal government had administered and managed for many years was outsourced. So by the time we were asking to get access to the vaccine safety data link, the federal government was able to say, well, we don't possess it anymore. It's not ours anymore. Where is it? Well, it was outsourced with the promise of $200 million over the course of 10 years to manage it, to the National Trade Association for the health insurance companies, for the HMOs. Public resource, a rich source of information to address critical issues of fact and public policy relating to vaccine safety, and that database is locked up and the government's hidden the key. We have been fighting to get that, and we're going to continue fighting to get that. During the course of this litigation, petitioners have also gone to industry as a third party. Although industry is completely protected from any liability in this system, as the people who designed, tested, manufactured, and distributed these products, we thought, as a matter of common sense, that it might make sense to get information about the safety of their products from the manufacturers. And again, vaccine industry and their lawyers intervened several times. Even though they cannot be liable in this program, they still show up to argue why they should simply have to give information and provide information that, again, would be available as a matter of course in civil litigation. It's another example of the federal government and industry standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder, standing between the petitioners and important relevant information and keeping that information from the special masters to boot. Now, the Department of Justice is, I think, somewhat proud of having produced some documents, a couple of 100,000 pages of documents. It's important to understand what those documents are. Those are product license applications. About 98% of the documents produced by the federal government to the petitioners in this litigation are those PLAs, as they're called for short. Well, again, you've got the government and industry working together, because those PLAs are materials that are submitted by the manufacturers to the FDA to get products approved, to get warning labels approved, to get licenses approved to sell and distribute their biological products. So it's industry information held by the government, and when we get it, well, industry has had a chance to sit down with government lawyers and redact and white out and black out huge chunks of information. trade secrets, proprietary information, all sorts of things that they claim are confidential and privileged and protected and have to remain secret. Now, petitioners didn't even get a chance to look and see whether any of those claims of privilege are true. That was done, again, by industry lawyers and the government lawyers working together. So what we have are a couple of 100,000 pages of heavily redacted, often blank, documents, largely irrelevant to the issues here. It's a mountain of haystacks in search of a needle. There's not a needle in there, as far as I can tell. It took 3 years to get there, too. Finally, in talking about the discovery process and the search for information, 3 years ago, the petitioners realized that in England, in the United Kingdom, there was litigation going on that involved the MMR, not Thimerosal, but the MMR. And it was litigation that had proceeded for a couple of years, generating a huge amount of material, and in particular, generating dozens of expert reports from both sides of the issue. Recognizing it makes sense to not have to reinvent the wheel if you've got 60-plus expert reports from litigation that has been going on for a few years looking at some of the same fact issues we knew would present themselves in this litigation, we asked the special masters to subpoena from the manufacturers copies of those expert reports. We weren't asking them to go out and generate new reports and spend a bunch of money to hire people and write summaries and interview witnesses. We were simply asking for copies of what had already been developed and produced in the UK litigation. Of course, industry resisted. The special masters did not issue a subpoena. We never saw that information. But we find out a couple of weeks ago that the federal government, your federal government, headed over to the United Kingdom. They headed over to the United Kingdom and they asked, under a new special procedure that the British courts have, a procedure apparently not in place when petitioners were making their request, your federal government went to the UK and asked selected documents over there be unsealed, because all of these reports were subject to a protective order by the British court under British law. And it got to the point where, less than a week before a trial here, apparently reports from the UK were coming back to the government. Now, it wasn't all 65 reports. Apparently it wasn't an application to say, let us see everything in this important litigation to really air these issues out and provide the facts that the special masters and the parties are going to need to make a better decision for all these kids on these important claims. What was being brought over, ultimately, were cherry-picked documents that are going to help, supposedly, the respondent side of the case. Now, when those documents come in, if they ever come in, is going to be an issue and has been an issue of debate. Petitioners obviously believe that some of these documents shouldn't even come in, at least in the Cedillo case here, because they are so late and so voluminous. And my understanding is some of them might not be introduced here, but may be introduced in other test cases down the road. No coincidence that at the same time your federal government was applying in the UK, one government to another, industry was over there asking for the same thing. Industry was over there asking the British court to unseal documents, selective documents, that could be used against some petitioners who've left this program following the rules and have civil cases pending in federal courts in the United States. Again, industry and government, shoulder to shoulder, side by side, cherry-picking information to use to do anything they can to further their common goal of denying compensation to these children, denying compensation to these families, and making sure that these folks don't have the evidence they need to move forward and put on the best possible case. Now, a lot of people have asked, well, why has it taken so long to get this first test case teed up here, 5 years, almost 5 years? We're 1 month short of when that special order, the general order, was entered creating the omnibus. Well, I think there are two reasons. The first is that the science has been evolving. When these first claims were filed, individual claims back in 2000, 2001, 2002, and back when the omnibus proceeding was set up in the middle of 2002, the science was new, and there was a lot of investigation and research going on by universities, by private researchers, by the government, probably even by industry. The government's own science, by the way, is still a work in progress. We know that there are case control studies, for example, that are looking at a possible relationship and association between thimerosal and neurological injuries. Government's been investigating that for years. We're here 5 years after the omnibus, and that still isn't published. There was a study looking by the CDC looking at Italy, looking at unexposed and exposed cohorts of children to again investigate the hypothesis that thimerosal might be associated with neurological injuries. Haven't seen that study yet either. Still in progress. Another case control study in the United States looking specifically at an association between thimerosal and autism spectrum disorders. Haven't seen that study yet either. These studies and other studies, the ongoing science, that was the main reason that the petitioners, when we've realized that there's science about to come out, have asked the special masters to allow that science to ripen. Again, so that they can make the best decision possible for this large number of very serious injury claims. And the science has been moving apace, but science and the law, I think, both have a tendency to go fairly slowly. And when you combine them and you have that interface between science and the law, it takes a while, but it's okay to take a while to make the best decision. And that's been the petitioner's position all along. It's also extremely important to understand, and I've heard respondent make the argument, well, you don't really need discovery and you don't need a lot of the things that you've been asking for, because when you filed those cases, you knew what your theory was, and you ought to be able to move ahead and prove your theory without waiting to get all this information from industry or from us. Well, you need to understand that having enough information to lead you to file a case is not the same thing as meaning you have all the evidence you need to try the case. And that's especially important when you remember the statute of limitations. These injured kids and their families had 3 years from the date that the very first symptom appeared to file a claim in this program, even if at that time they had no idea that it was a symptom of autism. Even before sometimes autism was diagnosed. Even if they were told by their doctors or other healthcare providers that no, the vaccines had nothing to do with it. Because that clock started running for a lot of these families before they knew it. And your federal government, through the respondent here, will look at these cases with 20/20 hindsight. They will go look at medical records, and they'll go as far back in time as they can to see something that they can argue is that first symptom. And then it's gotcha. Gotcha. That symptom happened 3 years and a day before you filed your claim, and you're going to be dismissed. And if you're dismissed, you have nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. So of course these families filed their claims before they were ready to try their case. And it's taken these years under that pressure of the statute of limitations with the developing science for these test cases to be ready to go. The other reason it's taken so long, I've already described. Information that would have been available as a matter of right is something that we have had to fight for the last 5 years and have met resistance and obstacle at every step of the way. So that's where we are, and that's how we got here. I want to talk about where we're going from here. I've talked a lot about industry, I've talked a lot about the respondent and the government, but as Special Master Hastings said in his introduction, those folks ultimately are not who are important here. The lawyers are not important, and with all respect, the most important people are not the special masters. The most important people here are the families, including folks like the Cedillos. These are families, as I said, who have played by the rules. They participated in immunization programs. They assumed a risk. They got injured for the common good. And we need to remember that. They played by the rules by filing their claims in the program. They've played by the rules, waiting for the science and the evidence to develop so that they can put on a science-based case in this omnibus proceeding. And they've played by the rules by waiting it out. And these are families that in many cases have shown incredible fortitude, and it's a privilege to represent them. Support groups, support networks, family groups, medical providers willing to go out on a limb to do what they can for their kids. They haven't given up on this system. They have not given up on the system, and that's why they're here. And as we move forward, just as they haven't given up on their own kids and they haven't given up on the system, they haven't given up on the hope that they're going to be treated fairly, that these proceedings moving forward will be open, that they'll be transparent, that they'll be fair. They have the hope that justice will be had. They expect nothing more, and they deserve nothing less. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. And now I understand Ms. Chin Kaplan will make an argument specifically on behalf of the Cedillo family.
Special Master Hastings, Special Master Kim Smith. My name is Sylvia Chin Kaplan, and I, along with my partners Kevin Conway and Ron Homer, represent Michelle Cedillo. I'd like you to know who Michelle is, because her life has been very short, but yet it's been fraught with healthcare issues, and certainly not one that a normal child would ever want, or that parents would ever want for their child. Michelle was born on August 30th, 1994. She weighed 8 pounds, roughly, and her APGARs were 9 and 9. In other words, she was perfectly healthy. On day one, when she was born, she received a hepatitis B immunization, and it contained 12.5 micrograms of mercury. Parents didn't know about it. The majority of the health profession didn't know about it. And Michelle went to her regular doctor's visit. Her parents, this was the first child. This was the only child. They wanted this child very bad. And they were going to give her the very best medical care that she could ever have. They took her to her regular doctor's appointments. They gave her all her immunizations, because that was what was recommended. They took her when she was sick. They nurtured her, because this was their child, and they wanted the very best that they could have for her. So because they wanted the very best that they could have for her, they took her for her other immunizations. 1 month after she was born, she went for hepatitis B number 2, another 12.5 micrograms of mercury. So we now have 25 micrograms of mercury in a cumulative dose in a child who was only 1 month. And because they were such good parents, they took her for more immunizations. They took her for her DTT and her HIV. And the doctors were very knowledgeable. They didn't want her to get more shots than she needed to get. So she got a combined shot, a DPT and HIV combined. But that DPT and HIV combined also contained mercury. It contained 25 mercury. So by the age of 4 months, Michelle had received 50 micrograms of mercury. Now, there are other immunizations recommended, and Michelle's parents knew this, and she took them. They took her for her immunizations. So in October of 1994, she went for another series of immunizations, and then in she went for her DPT and HIV, again, which contained another 25 micrograms per mole. So by the age of approximately 7 months, Michelle had received 3 DPT immunizations. She'd received 3 hepatitis immunizations, and each DPT immunization combined with the HIB contained 25 micrograms, and each hepatitis C immunization contained 12.5 micrograms. So you add up the math. So during this period of time, Michelle seemed to be okay. She was happy, she was interacting, she was starting to walk, she was meeting her milestones. Her pediatricians didn't think there was anything wrong with her. And in December of 1995, Michelle went in for another immunization, another regularly scheduled immunization. She went for her MMR. 1 week later, Michelle developed a fever of 105. Her mother called the doctor, and she was told, there's a flu going on, a very bad flu. So keep her at home, nurse her, and she'll recover. That fever stayed up. 105 on December 27th, 105 on December 28th, 105 on December 29th, 105 on December 30th, and yet she was told it's the flu. So finally on December 31st, it broke. It came down, and her mother thought, thank God, she's finally gone. Because, you know, when she's having this fever, she's not very well at all. So after this fever ended, around December 31st, Michelle was in her uterus. But her mother thought, she's recovering from this fever. So let's give her some time. And then the fever came back. Came back in early January, around January 5th. And as soon as it came back, her mother was on the phone calling the doctor saying, the fever has come back. So they told her to bring her in. And when they brought her in, they said, it's sinusitis. They gave her some antibiotics, and they sent her home. Well, that fever lasted about 2 days. And after that, Michelle's family heard that she wasn't sleeping. She was totally silent. And before that, she'd been interacting with her parents, with her grandparents. She'd been interacting with her cousins. She was babbling. She was reaching for her toys. She was walking practically. She was sitting up by herself. She didn't do anything. She suddenly became silent. She became involved in a little world of her own. She started to engage in repetitive behavior. Her family would say, Michelle, Michelle. She ignored her, but she never heard of her. So parents got really concerned. They told the doctors this. And what we see is that the doctors would say, has lost some words since the fevers. And nothing else. Now, before this, during December, when in the midst of this high fever, Michelle started to vomit. You have a high fever, you have a fever, you can expect some nausea and vomit and diarrhea. Michelle started vomiting. She developed diarrhea. She continued to vomit after the fever was gone. She continued to have diarrhea. She had diarrhea for almost 32 weeks continuously. And on this will progress at the same rate, some are slower, some are faster, but she should be okay. And her parents believe the doctors, because they're highly educated professionals, and they want to take care of the children. And Michelle's parents believe that then, they believe that now. So they watched, and they waited. And she, Michelle, Teresa, asked everyone around her, is this right? Is this right? Why doesn't she answer when I call her? Why is she playing by herself and she doesn't want to interact with anybody else? Why does she plot? Why does she engage in these repetitive behaviors? And most of all, why is she not talking? She talked before. Why is she not talking now? So finally, when there didn't seem to be any answers anywhere, Michelle went to another pediatrician who referred her to an adult neurologist. And the adult neurologist in his medical records took down her history and noted the high fevers. And in his notes he said, probable post-immunization reaction would have affected hearing, we don't know. She's delayed, and we recommended that she get referred for an evaluation. And in July of 1997, Michelle saw Dr. Roth, approximately 18 months after MMR. Dr. Roth did an evaluation, noted the history again of the high fevers, and Dr. Roth made the diagnosis that Michelle was autistic. The Sevilles didn't know what autism was. And they were told that in all likelihood, Michelle was never going to be able to take care of us. That she was probably going to require institutionalization. And they were told that they should probably do it now. Michelle and Michael Sedillo refused to institutionalize the child. They vowed that this child that they had wanted so very badly, their one child, their only child, was going to be cared for by them and their family at home. And they would provide as much care as she needed for as long as they could possibly provide it. Now, if this were the only problem that Michelle had, they could potentially manage. But over the years, as Michelle grew older, her diarrhea persisted. And she developed these eating habits. She wouldn't eat anything. She would hit herself in the chest. She would hit herself in the head. She didn't like new situations. She didn't want to go out of the house. And when her parents tried to get treatment for her, they brought in the ADA treatment, Michelle couldn't tolerate the fact that there were new people coming into her life. So, Teresa started to homeschool Michelle. Now, whenever Teresa asked the doctors, what can I do? What can I do to make my daughter healthy? What can I do to help her maximize her potential? What can I do to ensure that she can speak? That she can at least take care of herself? Maybe be a productive member of society? Is that too much to ask? And the doctors and Emily said, there's nothing you can do. She's autistic. So Teresa was not willing to accept her own child, her only child. She was determined that her child would progress as much as she could and would be able to function to the best of her ability. So she started searching on the internet. She started searching for answers on the web. She met other families and she heard about potential treatments coming out and doctors who were potentially making some discoveries that could help her. And then she learned that there were doctors in a group called Defeat Autism Now who were getting together for a conference. And the public was invited to listen to what these doctors had learned and were hoping could potentially provide treatment. The listened to Dr. Wakefield talk. And she stood in the room, and she waited for him to finish speaking so that she could catch him and try to get his attention about helping her child. You hear that he's leaving the room, and she's chasing him down to see if she can get answers for her child. Because this was her life. This was her life. And she was going to try and help her. In searching the net, Teresa also came across the fact that there was a secretin study going on where she lived. And she managed to get Michelle enrolled in the study. As part of the study, it was required that she undergo endoscopy. And endoscopy is essentially you look at the GI tract and count to five. But in Michelle's case, they only looked at it up here. So they looked at the top. And when she underwent this procedure in 2000, what they found was a grade 3 ulcer between the stomach and the esophagus. And they thought, and they, but her GI doctor at that point said, that's why she's hitting herself. That's why she's hitting herself in the chest, because that ulcer is causing her so much pain. That's why she can't eat, because that ulcer is causing her so much pain. So they treated her, and they did another endoscopy, and then another endoscopy, they found that it had healed. And at that, and then they also decided that because she was part of the study, the secretin study, they had to open up her in a low GI. And they had to see whether the secretin was helping or not. So at this lower GI that was performed in January of 2002, her treating doctor at that time, gastroenterologist, took a gut biopsy. And he took this gut biopsy and he sent it off to a lab called Unigenetics in Ireland. Months later, that biopsy came back positive. It's positive. But what do we know about it? How are you going to treat it? Most of all, how do you get rid of it? Maybe there's a chance for Michelle. If you get rid of it, maybe she would gain function. Maybe she'll be able to be a productive member of society. Maybe she could delay, but maybe she can talk again. There were no answers out there. So, Michelle's condition not only to worse. She ended up in the hospital because she was unable to eat. She was unable to drink. And she was admitted for dehydration, and her mother called gastroenterologist and said, she's here. They want to transfer you to her care because you're a gastroenterologist. And she was told, that's a general pediatric problem. Don't come. Her mother was stunned. All she wants is to provide care. And they were not going to provide even the most basic. So Michelle stayed in this hospital. She was treated for dehydration. And while she was in the hospital, her parents noted she didn't seem to be able to see. And you ask, well, how do you determine whether a child is sick or not? And her parents would say, they would approach her face and pretend that they're human. But she never reacted. So consult was put in for an ophthalmologist. And they said that she had uveitis, but it was not an adult ophthalmologist because, unfortunately, where Teresa lives, there is not a large pediatric practice for any of the subspecialties. They recommended she go and see a pediatric ophthalmologist. They stabilized her condition. During this hospitalization also, they noticed that her leg was and the rheumatology people. But they were adult rheumatologists. They were not pediatric rheumatologists. Because there wasn't any pediatric rheumatologists where they lived. So they thought she had juvenile welfare. It was mentioned, but they didn't know. And they recommended that she go and find a pediatric rheumatologist. So, meanwhile, Ms. Teresa continues to serve on the mend. And she finds that there's a GI doctor who has been treating her. And he was going to appear at the next day in conference. In true to form, Teresa chased down Dr. Creason because she wanted health insurance. And Dr. Creason agreed to consult with her, and while she was hospitalized, was consulting with the treating doctors about what to do with Michelle's problems, her GI problems in particular. When Michelle was well enough, she did go to New York. She traveled to New York with her family and Michelle, and had her evaluated by Dr. Creason. And you'll hear Dr. Creason. He'll come in and testify on behalf of his patient. You'll hear that Dr. Creason has had probably the most experience in treating this enterocolitis of autistic children. You'll hear that the history that he obtained, the clinical signs, presentation, the appearance on endoscopy, the pathological findings that he saw, the tests that he ran, they were all entirely consistent with a child who had a persistent viral infection. And because they had previously obtained measles in her gut, back in 2002, he believed it was more probably than not the measles that was causing the problem. So Michelle went home. And at this hospitalization for dehydration, because she couldn't eat or drink, they had to insert what's known as a peg tube. It's a feeding tube for nutrition. Dr. Creason consulted on a long-distance basis. But because Michelle's care was so complicated, her parents decided that they needed somebody closer. And Dr. Creason wholeheartedly agreed with that. You need somebody closer. So they went to San Diego Children's Hospital in Arizona, a ride of 3 hours to obtain care for her. Because she was their one child, their only child. And they were going to try and do the very best they could. And at San Diego Children's, they saw a pediatric rheumatologist. And he thought that she had an arthritis that was related to her bowel disease. And while there, she also saw a pediatric ophthalmologist. And he thought that her eye problems were related to her bowel disease and her arthritis. And at that pediatric ophthalmology exam, she found out that Michelle had lost 90% of the function of her optic nerve. Michelle was almost blind. So he ordered treatment. And luckily that has stabilized to a certain extent. And Michelle can once again engage in the few activities that give her any sort of pleasure, such as watching her Sesame Street. Now, you will hear evidence that mercury is one of the most toxic substances in the world. Doesn't matter whether it's methylmercury, ethylmercury, or mercury. It affects all bodily tissues, including the immune system. You'll hear evidence of how the world discovered how toxic mercury was. The first mass contamination case occurred in Yamato, Japan, where the population there ate fish that consumed a substance that was containing mercury. And their children, the children who were exposed in the were born with these incredible central nervous system. Some died, some didn't. Minamata. And then the world also gave us the grain contamination cases in Iraq, where poor farmers were given seed grain that was coated with a preservative, whether it be methylmercury or ethylmercury, and not knowing, washed the seeds and made it into bread. And they ate that bread that was contaminated with the methylmercury or the ethylmercury. And those people came down with problems, central nervous system problems, among other things. And their children who were exposed came down with problems. And their children who were exposed only through breast milk came down with central nervous system problems. Among one of the most toxic substances in the world. Because of this, you'll hear that the federal government's funded two studies, the Seychelles Islands and the Faroe Islands. The Faroe Islands, somewhere up in the North Atlantic, looked at people who ate pilot bread. The Seychelles, down someplace warmer, had people who had a steady state of fish where they died. The two studies were not consistent. So the White House convened a panel to look at why are these two studies not consistent. And the members of that panel, very august body of toxicologists who had a great deal of experience with metal toxicity and mercury toxicity, came to some conclusions and made some recommendations. And when those recommendations were followed, they found that the studies were consistent with one another. That low-level mercury exposure could cause neurological problems. And shortly thereafter, a third study came out from New Zealand. Smaller study, but supportive of that same premise. That low-level mercury can cause central nervous system problems. Now, you may wonder, what is a safe dose? Is there a safe dose? Well, EPA came out with a safe dose. 0.1 microgram per kilogram of body weight per day over your lifetime. If you do the math, you will find that Michelle Cedillo's mercury level exceeded that from the day of birth. You're thinking, well, why is that so dangerous? It's dangerous because it's a baby. A baby who has an immature immune system. A baby who has an immature neurological system. It's growing still. It's developing. And the mercury can affect both systems. And you may wonder, why not everyone? Because everybody received it, but not everybody came out with these problems. And you'll hear evidence that the immunization schedule is a schedule. It's not administered at one set date and time. There's a range of time in which it's considered. And you'll hear also that neurological and immunological development has a schedule as well. And it's also a range of time. And before you can have harm, you must have that exposure occurring at this vulnerable period of time in a child's life. And the petitioner submits that that is what happened in Michelle Cedillo's case. You'll hear evidence from scientists that the measles that was discovered in her gut has caused the persistent GI problem, the persistent diarrhea, the persistent constipation. And that, in conjunction with the mercury, has affected her ability to clear this measles from her body. And what happens when you have persistent measles virus? Is this something new? Is this something that we don't know anything about? No. We do know that people can develop persistent measles infection that doesn't manifest itself. There's a long latency period. And we do know that years after exposure, these people come down with neurological problems. And medicine knows that, and they acknowledge that it occurs. So what about Michelle? Does her case matter? time of exposure will determine the type of harm to have. So in this situation, when you have persistent measles that won't go away because the immune system has been affected by primarosal, which was given earlier, it allows the measles virus to enter the neurons. And when it enters the neurons, it can affect the function of the brain. It doesn't necessarily affect the appearance of the neurons, but it can affect the function of the brain. Do we know that this happens? Well, there's certainly evidence that it happens, and there's a very well-known researcher who has been looking at persistent viral infections for a very long time, and he firmly believes that it happens. You'll hear evidence from this case that in one of the doctors that Michelle's parents saw here from, that their immune healing was performed. And they looked at her immune system. And you'll hear evidence that doctor indicates that her immune system was almost perfect. You'll hear evidence that this physician subsequently published an article which indicates that autistic children that he saw had what's known as a skewing of Th2. In other words, the immune system was skewed toward one particular element in the immune system. And because it was skewed in that manner, it couldn't clear infections, such as viruses. You'll hear evidence that mild measles can cause both GI problems, gastrointestinal problems, as well as central nervous system problems. That's well acknowledged. And it's acknowledged also that the vaccine strain can do the same thing, albeit on a much reduced level. You'll hear evidence that Michelle has both the GI problem and the central nervous system problem. And you'll hear that more probably than not, Michelle's current condition, her autism, her arthritis, her uveitis, her persistent GI problems are probably related. And they're probably related to the fact that her immune system has been affected by the mercury that was contained in her vaccine and prevented the measles virus from being eliminated from her body. This program that you're sitting here, that the special masters have run for a number of years, was created by Congress as a social compact between the public and potential people who have been harmed by vaccines. Everybody knows that depending on who you are, you will react to substances that other people will not react to. That's not an experience. In exchange to protect the public, the government has asked that we immunize everybody, that we parents immunize the children. The Cedillos accept that, and they did that. But in exchange for this promise, Congress said that this program will take care of your children when they get home. The Cedillos are here to ask these three special masters to honor the intent of Congress in taking care of Michelle Cedillo for the rest of her life when her parents are no longer able to do so.
Thank you, Ms. Chin Catherine. We'll next hear from Respondents' Council. I understand that Respondents' Council wants to address some of the arguments made by the petitioner's counsel at this time and reserve the rest of his opening for the beginning of the government's case, which will be next week. But Mr. Madanowski, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, thank you for graciously letting me split my opening to speak briefly about the overall program issues that were raised primarily by Mr. Powers, and then to reserve my more specific case-specific comments to the beginning of the government's case. It's interesting, I know that the folks who are listening in can't see this, but the podium that I'm standing before offers you a choice. You really can either turn towards the special masters and address them, or turn towards the audience and address the audience. And I noticed that the petitioner's counsel both addressed the audience rather than, and they had their backs to the special masters. I'd submit that this choice that you have is to direct your comments, or at least face those who will be deciding the case. And that's not to diminish the importance of those standing or sitting in the crowd here or listening in. It's that they are listening in, they're not deciding this case, so my comments aren't directed to you, though of course you're welcome to listen to them. My comments are directed to the bench. First, I'd like to address where Mr. Powers started, and that's with the vaccine program. Now, he pointed out that the vaccine program exists in part to divert litigation from civil proceedings to this court. Now, it's interesting, though, that at that point he professes surprise that the federal government, your federal government, as he reminds you, entered a case, a civil case, it was in Oregon, and explained to the federal judge there that cases involving vaccine injuries needed to be brought before this court. That case was proceeding under an attempt to find a loophole in the very program that Mr. Powers is here talking about today. Now, he also failed to mention that the government's position was not only vindicated there, but was vindicated by a special master of this court. That special master, the chief special master, found that cases involving such vaccine injuries needed to be brought in front of this court. And Mr. Powers tried to present the government's intervention in that federal case in Oregon as the government standing shoulder to shoulder, and he used that term several times, with vaccine manufacturers. Well, I happen to be the government attorney who appeared in Oregon, and I remember very distinctly who I was standing shoulder to shoulder with. I was sitting next to Mr. Powers and his partner, Mr. Williams, in the table in front of this federal judge in making my case. And in fact, my case, in very pertinent parts, stood in opposition to several points that the vaccine manufacturers were making. I was very careful to distinguish certain cases that need not be brought in front of this court. Mr. Powers also discussed the proceedings before this court, the long history, and I'd like to discuss that hopefully briefly. He mentioned that short form cases were brought. That was at the petitioner's or the PSC's insistence. He indicates that those needed to be brought because there were time periods that were so short he didn't have time, or the petitioners wouldn't have time to file their records before they get their cases before the court. Now, what he doesn't mention is, did they not have time to actually make an allegation of what injury it was? These short-form petitions provide no information at all about what the theory is. In fact, every single one of them provides at least three different theories that the petitioners can proceed under. These are placeholder. What the secretary is forced to defend against is about 5,000 cases that the secretary knows nothing about. Knows nothing more, in the majority of those cases, than the names of the petitioners. What he also didn't mention is that if time was of the essence, and that's why short-form petitions were necessary, that they needed to be filed because there was not time to collect those records before the statute of limitations would run. What's he been doing? What's the petitioner steering committee been doing in the last 5 years? Those cases have sat for that time without any records being filed. If time is of the essence, I'm sure that 5 years would have been more than enough time to collect those records and get a file. He's complained about the frustrations the PSC has had in discovery. In fact, the PSC has received more data from the government in these proceedings than in all other vaccine cases combined over the almost 20-year history of the program. He's received over 218,000 pages of government documents. He complains that the answers weren't in there. Those were the documents he requested. Those were the documents the PSC sought. Now, it's true they didn't seek everything they were looking for, and he says he had to fight, or the PSC had to fight, every step of the way to get this information. They had to fight and file motions to compel. All of that material that they were provided by the federal government was provided without them filing a motion to compel. Every single motion to compel that they have filed for anything that was not provided to them, they've lost. I submit to you that the federal government's resistance in certain instances to their broad requests was vindicated by your decisions in this case. They deposed government officials from the Centers for Disease Control, from the National Institutes of Health, from the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, and from the National Institutes of Environmental Health Science, and from the Food and Drug Administration. They received all of this discovery in a program that Congress said should not involve extensive discovery. Now listen closely to what you hear in this case. You won't hear that discovery being used in this case. They indicated that most of the documentary evidence that they received was in the form of PLAs, product license applications. That's what they requested. They indicated that those applications or that information wasn't given by the federal government until the information had been reviewed by the manufacturers that submitted it. What he failed to mention was that federal law required that. What he failed to mention was that the manufacturers stood ready to sue the Food and Drug Administration if necessary, if the Food and Drug Administration were to reveal trade secret information in the materials given to the Food and Drug Administration. He mentions also that during the course of the litigation, manufacturers, as he put it, intervened in these proceedings. Actually, I think you'll recall that what happened was the PSC sought subpoenas against the manufacturers, and that in discovery, in this program, it's discovery for your purposes. You have to, special masters, determine that you need the information. And it was at your invitation that the manufacturers were invited before the court to provide their views so that you could decide whether you needed that information or not. And what he failed to mention was that you decided that you did not need that information. What he also failed to mention is that the federal government did not oppose those subpoenas. That is because the federal government did not have a position, did not have a stake in that fight. So there's been some talk about the government's efforts to receive certain information that had been filed in litigation in the United Kingdom. This has been characterized as cherry picking on behalf of the government, that they chose only certain information that had been filed in that proceeding and presented before you. In fact, the reports received, obtained by our efforts, in essence, have balanced the scales. The petitioners here actually cherry-picked a few experts that had presented evidence in the United Kingdom litigation and presented them before you. You'll now have before you both, you'll have those experts, and you'll also have the views of other experts who actually had the ability to take a look at the Unigenetics lab, at Dr. O'Leary's lab, to take a look at the information, the lab reports, the equipment, the lab layout, and determine whether or not measles virus could be reliably detected by their methods. I think you'll find it interesting, as we did, once you review that information, that the petitioner's experts failed to mention any of this in their reports. Now, petitioners mentioned that it took 5 years to get to this point. They indicate that that was because science was developing, that they needed that time to develop their cases. In fact, when you hear the evidence before that'll unfold in the next 2 to 3 weeks, you'll find that nothing that you hear here could not have been presented when this trial was originally scheduled to be heard in 2004. There's no new theory here. There's no new evidence that was developed in the course of the 5 year wait that we've had to get to this point. I want to depart just for a moment to talk a little bit about the notion that the government will move to dismiss untimely cases. Well, yes, the government will dismiss untimely cases. Move to dismiss it. Untimely cases are cases that are barred by statute from being before you. They're not legally supposed to be here. That's why we move to dismiss, and if you agree, that's why you would be compelled to dismiss them. I listened very carefully to the PSC arguments regarding the fairness of these proceedings. The ill motives of the government, the purposes of the vaccine program, from the PSC's view, the dangers of vaccines. What I didn't hear this morning in comments was how this case is a causation in fact case, and how vitally important in a causation in fact case it is that the result be determined by the dictates of good science. Now, good science has been given definition and meaning by the Supreme Court of the United States. Petitioner's argument that the requirements of good science shouldn't find place here flies in the face of that Supreme Court precedent. They've argued that in their papers. Good science does apply. It has to apply here. What has no place here in any federal court is junk science. What has no place here are experts at the margins of legitimate science who present untested theories, untested hypotheses, speculation, conjecture, logical fallacies based on post hoc, ergo propter hoc reasoning. Nothing in the congressional history of this act suggests that the court is to accept bad science. The PSC reminds you that the standard here is preponderance of the evidence. That's true. It's also not news. That's been the standard since the Vaccine Act began. So for almost 20 years, we've been operating under that standard. In fact, that's the standard in all civil proceeding in this country. It was the standard in Daubert. What's critically important, though, is what kind of evidence goes into meeting that standard. What's critically important is that that evidence be reliable, that it be good science in this instance, because we're going to be essentially addressing a scientific question. What you need to consider in judging this is whether that science that they're presenting to you meets that standard. Does it meet the dictates of Daubert as reliable science? You need tested hypotheses, You need good, legitimate lab results. You need testimony that can withstand critical examination. You need thorough study. That's what forms the bedrock of good science. Unfortunately, after 5 years to prepare their case, the PSC will not present that to you. Search as you may, you'll find no support for key links in their theoretical chain of causation. You'll find that their witnesses presented views that find no place in reliable science. You'll find a signal lack of support for their contentions. You'll find that their hypotheses are untested, or when tested, they've been shown to be false. You'll even find the support they cite for critical aspects of their case has been discredited. Their experts and their expert testimony will be discredited here because their opinions are nothing more than that. Their opinions, they were developed for litigation, they're unsupported, and they're held by these experts alone. They're not science. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Matanowski. Ms. Chin Kaplan, should we start with the testimony of Dr. Poshian then? All right. Dr. Poshian, if you could take the witness stand here. And I think Ms. Chin Kaplan will perhaps go roughly a half an hour into Dr. Poshian's testimony, and then we'll take our morning break. So go ahead. Dr. Poshian, if you could raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give us will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Okay. Please go ahead, Ms. Chin Kaplan.
Thank you, Special Master. Dr. Poshian, would you kindly state your name for the record, please? Could you kindly state your name for the record, please?
My name is H. Bashman Poshian.
Dr. Poshian, what is your current business address?
Tucson, Arizona, 857.
What is your current position?
I'm professor of molecular and cellular biology, and I'm also in active science, and I'm also professor of oncology in the medical school at the University of Arizona.
Could you kindly give a description of your educational background from undergraduate, please?
I received my undergraduate degree in practical science and chemistry at Brown University in 1948. I received a master's degree and a PhD in physiological chemistry at the University of Rochester. I did a postdoctoral with Nobel laureate at the Department of Chemistry at Stanford University School of Medicine. I've done sabbatical residence at MIT and at the University of California, San Diego.
Doctor, are you a toxicologist?
People call me other things, but they also call me an environmental toxicologist.
And what is an environmental toxicologist?
Environmental toxicologists are interested in understanding how chemicals in the environment will affect the health of human beings.
And doctor, as part of your position as an environmental toxicologist, have you consulted to other countries or other governmental bodies on mercury?
I've been a consultant to our government on a variety of National Institutes of Health committees, including Earth Administration committees, the Environment Protection Agency Commission, administration committees. I think the Atomic Energy Bureau, Foundation, Energy Commission. In foreign countries, I was a consultant to the governments of China, the autonomous region of Mongolia, Romania, Chile,
consulted to these agencies and foreign governments, was your consultation related to mercury?
The studies in Mexico concentrated on mercury. The studies in Mongolia, Southwest China, Romania, and Chile emphasized the exposure of the population to arsenic and mercury.
Now, the substances that you consulted on, are they considered to be heavy metals?
Yes. That is what I deal with in the laboratory, what I deal with in the teaching, what I deal with in the writing.
So, have you conducted research on heavy metals?
Oh, yes, since 1955.
And have you conducted research on mercury?
On mercury. In 1957, published the first study which showed that in experimental animals, a new drug that we developed and others helped develop would prevent the lethal effects of mercurochlorine.
And Dr. Begibin, but have you published articles on the effects of mercury?
Yes, many. I can't give you the number.
And do some of those publications involve the effects of mercury on the health of individuals?
Yes.
And you indicated that you teach. Who do you teach?
I'm very fortunate to teach a small class of about 15 to 20 students. These are seniors who are going on to graduate school, medical school, or professional school, like law school. These are very carefully chosen students that we think are going to be the future leaders of the community. And I teach these students how this biology that they've been taught prior to my seeing them is relevant to their everyday life, to their exposure to metals, to mercury, to arsenic, to lead, their exposure to PCBs and other toxins.
Doctor, you mentioned that you consult to governmental agencies. Are you familiar with a group that was convened by the White House to study the situation with mercury and emissions? To study mercury.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Are you familiar with a conference that was convened by the White House to study mercury?
Yes, I was a member of that conference.
And, Doctor, the other members of the panel, did they also possess an expertise in mercury?
Many of them had such an expertise.
Doctor, can you describe to the court what the purpose of this panel was?
A number of us were very concerned that three agencies of the federal government could not agree on an RFP, that is, a safe dose, the dose that you're exposed to each day for the rest of your life, mercury, there would be no harm done to you. We're concerned that the three agencies of the federal government could not agree on this. We're also concerned that the government, through the National Institutes of Environmental Sciences, had put millions of dollars, not just a million, but millions of dollars, into two studies, one up in the Seychelles Islands, one down in the Seychelles Islands, and went up in the Faroe Islands as far as the influence on the intelligence of children if their mothers ate a lot of fish that contained mercury. These two studies, at the time of the White House conference, were diametrically opposed as to the results. And we felt, a number of us felt, that the conference should be held to try to resolve these issues and try to advise the three government agencies that it's rather bizarre that three agencies of the federal government could not look at data and come to the same conclusion.
Doctor, could you generally describe for this court what the conclusions of that panel was?
The conclusions were, and recommendations were, that the University of Rochester investigators, who were the primary investigators in the Seychelles Island study, and the Faroe Island studies show that children born with mothers exposed to methylmercury in fish and seafood that ate had certain definite learning disorders. Clearly shown, they use what we call the name study. So the Session Island study said there were no effects. And again, each group used a different test to test the intelligence of the children. We strongly recommended that both groups use the same tests. In addition, the Session Island study examined children at age 5. The Carroll Island study examined children at age 7. We recommended, since there were negative, there were results indicating harmful effects on the health of the child at 7 years of age, that the Session Island study should be done at 7 years of age also. And this was done subsequently, and so now we know that there are also results now in the Session Islands indicating that boys in the Session Island population have certain intelligence deficits at age 7 that match. We also recommended that the three government organizations, the FDA, the EPA, and toxicology group, the NIHS, should get together to try to solve their problems and communicate them. The result of this was the FDA, about 2 years ago, came up and said they agreed with the EPA that the RFD should be 0.1 micrograms of mercury per kilogram per day. The other group, I can never remember their name, so I seem to have a block. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, the ATSDR, they still have not changed. And they haven't changed because they are using the old Session Island data, not the new data, because that's not our approach.
Doctor, have you prepared an outline to assist the court in evaluating the toxicity of mercury?
Yes, may I go through it?
Certainly.
First, I'd like to talk about the forms of mercury, the target water sources. I'd like to consider the methylmercury disasters and epidemiology studies, the estimated daily intake and retention of mercury for the general population. Pink disease, which is due to a form of mercury, is a perfect example of the medical establishment being conservative and wrong. Very important studies now show that changes in the human gene that modify the effects of mercury on the biological process. I want to point out that there is now considerable evidence that autism is a mercury efflux disorder. I want to review ethylmercury and methylmercury for the court. I'd like to discuss Michelle Cedillo as far as her cumulative mercury exposure is concerned.
Thank you, Doctor. So, would you kindly describe for the court the forms of mercury?
The purpose of my making this slide was to acquaint and or review for the court the diversity and toxicological properties of various chemical forms of species of mercury. First of all, we have elemental mercury. Most of you are familiar with liquid silver, as it was called, our children used to play with this. elemental mercury in its liquid form is relatively non-toxic. But at room temperature, it emits a vapor, and that vapor is very, very toxic. Next slide. Organic mercury. And here we have a significant number of forms. Based on organic mercury, I could be exposed today to a very strong dose, a very toxic dose of organic mercury compound, and no manifestation of that toxicity, no sign or symptom would not appear until 4 or 5 months. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. An example of organic mercury is methylmercury found in fish. Another example is by Marisol, and the second enigma is why it was ever included in vaccines to begin with. And we'll talk about that. We have dimethylmercury, which is extremely toxic, so toxic it's called the super toxic form of mercury. Most toxicologists don't like to hear super toxic, but it's extremely toxic. And what happened was that a very talented young woman, a professor of chemistry at Dartmouth College, about 5 or 6 years ago, was actually 10 years ago, was working under the hood with dimethylmercury, which all of us have used to calibrate a certain specialized scientific instrument. While she was working under the hood, she dropped one or two drops, according to her notebook, of dimethylmercury on her latex cup. And she took the cup off, disposed of it. My wife and I were at a conference with Yuri Kapow, where we were in Malaysia, approximately 5 months later. We were having dinner, and she said, you know, I'm not sure, I'm not feeling well. I don't know whether I'm getting the flu or not. I've never had the flu, but I just don't feel well. That was December 1997. She went home, and she was hospitalized in February, and so the signs and symptoms occurred 5 to 6 months later. From the time she was exposed or dropped the mercury on her glove, and this wonderful woman died of severe mercury poisoning, I think it was in February of that year. This is an example of the most toxic form of mercury, and it's an example of what we didn't know at the time, and it was sent through the mail, we could order it anytime we wanted, but students worked with it, and it wasn't until this happened that now there are very rigid federal regulations as to how to find the
mercury. And Doctor, what you have described, are they considered to be organic forms of mercury?
Yes.
What happens to the, does organic become inorganic?
All these forms of mercury, organic mercury, are oxidized to what we call mercuric mercury. And mercuric mercury has a very high affinity to the sulfhydryl groups of enzymes, the active centers of enzymes. And mercuric mercury is a standard enzyme inhibitor used in the laboratory and can be used in vivo also.
And that's considered a form of inorganic mercury?
Yes, mercuric mercury is a form of inorganic mercury.
And what is the relationship between the organic mercuries and the inorganic mercuries?
The organic mercury in the human body, every one of them is converted, metabolized to some extent to mercuric mercury.
And is there another form of inorganic mercury?
We have mercurius mercury. This is enigma number 4, and that is why certain children were hyper susceptible to mercurius mercury. And they got Pink's disease. And we'll talk more about Pink's disease later. But this is a disease in which 1 out of every 500 children that were exposed to this teething powder that contained mercurius mercury, 1 out of 500 of them got Pink's disease.
Now, Doctor, what are the target organs for mercury?
Target organs, first of all, for mercury vapor, the brain, methylmercury, the brain, dimerosal, the brain and the kidney, mercuric mercury, the kidney.
And
the immune system is also affected by all of these.
And Doctor, could you kindly describe to the court where this mercury comes from?
Let's look at the sources of brain mercury as to where they come from. We have mercury vapor from the restoration of a cavity in the tooth or teeth, a dental amalgam, as we call it. that dental amalgam continuously emits mercury vapor. Even in those of you who have mercury fillings in your mouth, those mercury fillings are continuously emitting mercury vapor, which gets into the mouth, gets to the mucous cavity, and finally finds its way to the lungs. It's absorbed very quickly in the lungs, transported very quickly to the blood-brain barrier and to other tissues, but it crosses it. It's able to cross the blood-brain barrier, which is there. Blood-brain barrier is to protect the brain and not just others. But the mercury vapor is fatty, lipid-soluble, so it can diffuse right across. Once it gets into the brain, the mercury vapor is oxidized to mercuric mercury. Once that mercuric mercury is formed, it attaches to proteins and, in my opinion, stays there forever. And there's much evidence in the literature that shows that it can remain there for 25, 30 years. One other form of mercury, the methyl mercury, comes from fish. My students think this is a whale, so it's supposed to be a fish. And the methyl mercury combines. First of all, when you ingest fish, the methyl mercury in the fish, 95 to 99% is completely taken up by the GI tract. It's transported into the blood. The methyl mercury, since it hits the blood, a methyl mercury cysteine complex is formed. That methyl mercury cysteine complex looks to a transport system that carries the amino acid methionine from the blood into the brain, across the blood-brain barrier, providing the amino acid. That transport system cannot tell the difference between cysteine, methylmercury, and methionine, so it's transported into the cell as methylmercury. There it's slowly demethylated to form mercuric mercury, which again stays there. Then finally, we have the thimerosal from vaccine, which as soon as it enters the body is very quickly metabolized with ethyl mercury. That ethyl mercury, we don't know the mechanism, but we know from experiments that have been done that the ethyl mercury gets into the cell, gets across the blood-brain barrier, gets into the brain, and we know that the ethyl mercury is deethylated to form mercuric mercury. So all these different forms of mercury that the human being is exposed to, you're going to have this mercuric mercury remaining in the brain, doing some damage, as well as the parent compound, like the ethyl mercury, doing some damage.
So, Doctor, the mercuric mercury cannot leave the brain?
From all the studies that have been published, we have methyl mercury. Well, the best example I can give you was that in Mexico, there was a bottle of methyl mercury fungicide in the barn, and a hog tipped it over and drank it. The family didn't know this. The next day, they killed the hog for food, threw some of it away. There are three young children in the family that ate this meat. Children became very, very ill. One died. Another one survived for about 20 years. At the time of her death, she was autopsied, and at that time, 20 years after the exposure to methyl mercury, her mercuric mercury level in the brain was 100 times above normal.
Doctor, have there been some studies done on the effects of mercury on a person's health?
On children's health.
But have there been studies done by other people exposed to things such as dental amalgams?
Yes. May I have the next slide, please? Health effects of dental amalgam mercury now are getting more and more well documented. Papers published in peer-reviewed journals, and some are showing that those that monkeys that were exposed to that had amalgams put into their teeth, and then later were exposed for a time to the mercury emitted from these amalgams, that the bacteria in their GI tract had increased resistance to antibiotics. And this is now accepted by most people that I know, that amalgams how the mercury exposure will cause resistance, an increased resistance to antibiotics. There's a study done that's actually given a videotape of what's happening in vitro, amalgam, the mercury from dental amalgams will destroy snail brain neurons. They weren't able to get human neurons for the brain for obvious reasons, so they use snail neurons. In this video, you can see the actual disintegration of the neuron after exposure to amounts of elemental mercury equivalent to what would be emitted from the amalgam in our teeth. It's generally agreed that there is a hypersensitivity problem as far as dental amalgam is concerned. There's not agreement as to what percentage. There's one figure is 0.5% of the human population is hypersensitive, another figure is 15%. It just is not in agreement. And so, as far as the innate toxicity in humans, there are studies for it and studies against it, and we still have a lot more work. The problem is that most of the signs and symptoms of mercury toxicity, actually we call micromercurialism, are very nonspecific. We can't say that just human beings are sick. So a lot more has to be done with that. And there certainly is, and I hope to present evidence for this, or present a reference for it, now a higher susceptibility of a certain percentage of the population to amalgam.
Doctor, does mercury ever disappear?
No, mercury isn't an element. You can't destroy an element.
And Doctor, when you look at this next slide, does that indicate to the court what happens to mercury?
This more or less shows you where the methylmercury in fish comes from. You have mercury, elemental mercury vapor in the air. This elemental mercury vapor is always being emitted from the ground. It's being emitted from the ocean, and it's being emitted from electric utility plants that produce electricity by burning fossil fuels like oil and coal. So in the air, you have elemental mercury. This soon settles down by rain and other means into the water, lakes, oceans, etc., and the elemental mercury, the HGO, is oxidized to mercuric mercury. The mercuric mercury is, as you see down in the sediment, gets down in the sediment also, and that mercuric mercury is oxidized to mercuric mercury, and then there are certain bacteria found in the sediment of oceans and other places that will methylate mercuric mercury to form methyl mercury. And unicellular organisms will eat a little bit of we constantly pull this into them from the sediment and from the ocean where it's also and it goes through a process we call biomagnification, that a unicellular organism will have a little more, four or five cells, you have more, you find a small fish will concentrate more. So by the time it gets to the predator fish, there is a tremendous increase in the concentration of methylmercury in the predator fish as compared to what was originally injected in the water.
Doctor, have there been studies done about the health effects of exposure to mercury?
Ms. Chin Kaplan, before we go on to that, I think now would be a good time. Let's take our morning break. We'll take a 15-minute break. I ask one particular thing. We have limited restroom capacity on this floor. If you see one of the counsel or witnesses fighting you for the next stall, please let them go first so we can get back and finish up. But we'll take a 15-minute break, you folks at home. You might get some music, but we'll take a 15-minute break, and we will be back on then. Thank you.
Thank you.